You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World by John Valiant. This book was one of the Book Review's 10 best books of 2023. Is fire alive? The journalist and author John Valiant asks early in his new book, Fire Weather. I rolled my eyes, even as Valiant ticks off a dozen lifelike characteristics. It grows, it breathes, it travels in search of nourishment, because the answer seemed so obvious. No, of course not. Some 300 pages later, the question didn't feel quite so ludicrous. Valiant tells the story of a colossal wildfire that, in the spring of 2016, torched much of Fort Murray, a small city carved out of central Canada's boreal forest. It is a tale of firefighters, homeowners, and local authorities confronting a conflagration so intense that it generated its own weather systems, complete with hurricane-force winds and bolts of lightning. More than that, it is a real-life fable about the causes and consequences of climate change. Fort Murray, with a population of about 90,000, was created so that energy companies could extract bitumen, a sticky black substance that can be converted into synthetic crude oil, diesel, and a variety of other petroleum-based products from the tar sands of northern Alberta. More than 40% of American oil imports come from Fort McMurray. In other words, the gargantuan mining and processing operation, so vast that it is visible from 6,000 miles above Earth's surface, is a physical manifestation of the forces that have led to a warming world. It is also a physical manifestation of the grave threats posed by that warming world. A few decades ago, this would have been an unlikely setting for an out-of-control inferno, especially in the cool, damp months of spring. But in May 2016, temperatures soared into the high 80s, almost 30 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, and the air was as dry as a desert. The conditions, Valiant writes, were as conducive to fire as is possible anywhere on Earth. The small fire was first spotted in the forest southwest of Fort McMurray at 4 p.m. on Sunday, May 1st. When it didn't quickly sputter out, it was given an impersonal code by firefighters, MWF-009. The little brush fire grew exponentially, fueled by crispy trees and an unlucky wind. Even as the burgeoning blaze rushed toward the city, authorities were slow to grasp the magnitude of the danger. Before it was over, locals would rechristen 009 the Beast. To describe what happened next, Valiant takes full advantage of resources that previous generations of journalists could only have dreamed of. Cell phone cameras, dashboard cameras, security cameras, even stuffed animals with nanny cameras nestled inside. Countless people posted thousands of photos and videos to social media, and the digital trove, as well as interviews with witnesses, enables Valiant to vividly describe the fire as it devoured Fort McMurray. There was the instant that a clear blue sky was obliterated by a towering black cloud shot through with streaks of orange and seething with flames, transforming a sunny spring day into a long, dark night. There were the sounds of car tires, gas tanks, and propane-fueled grills detonating in awful synchrony as the fire ripped through tightly packed neighborhoods. There was the spooky view from a nanny cam as flames tentatively lapped at a window before incinerating the entire house. It is a gripping yarn, though the storytelling is at times slowed by Valiant's wanderings. There's a painstaking history of the use of bitumen over the millenniums. There's a discourse on the quasi-spiritual nature of fire and its many forms, which eventually meanders into a meditation on oxygen and human breathing. There's a lengthy rehashing of the roots of climate science, activism, and denialism. with a few poignant exceptions, including the story of a Fort McMurray welder named Wayne McGrath, who valiantly tries to fight off the blaze with his own demons. Fireweather lacks many memorable human characters, but Valiant fills that void with an unforgettable protagonist, fire itself. A raging wildfire is hard to fathom for anyone who has not stood in its path. Valiant is clearly in awe as he lovingly details 009's inner workings and apocalyptic fallout. The forests surrounding Fort McMurray consisted largely of black spruces that were dripping with flammable sap. As the tall trees ignited, the fire inhaled oxygen from below that spawned powerful and sustained winds that screamed up toward the treetops and then gusted embers and sparks hundreds of yards out from the fire, fueling its relentless growth. At the center of the fire, a jet of fast-rising, superheated air sucked hundreds of thousands of gallons of water from fire hoses, broken pipes, icy rivers, skyward. Miles overhead, the air cooled and the water vapor turned to carbon-infused ice, and hurricane-force downdrafts hurled fusillades of black hail back to the ground. Valiant notes that homes used to be crammed with natural materials, wooden tables and chairs, sofas stuffed with cotton, curtains made of lace. Flammable, yes, but not compared with today's combustible houses. Now furniture is made of plastic or wood composites, held together with resins and glues, and coated or filled with synthetic materials like nylon and polyurethane. Today, Valiant writes, it is common to find oneself sitting or sleeping on furniture composed almost entirely of petroleum products. No wonder, then, that within minutes, newly built homes in Fort McMurray were reduced to cinder. Valiant anthropomorphizes fire. Not only does it grow and breathe and search for food, it strategizes, it hunts, it lays in wait for months, even years. Valiant even quotes someone comparing forest fires to farmers cultivating their crops. Fire, of course, is not alive in any technical sense, but that doesn't make it a less daunting antagonist. Climate change has warmed the air and dried the soil, creating tinderbox conditions. As Valiant notes, around the world, fires are burning over longer seasons and with greater intensity than at any other time in human history. The catastrophe that ravaged Fort McMurray is probably an omen of what lies ahead. This review was written by David Enrich, the Times Business Investigations Editor, and the author most recently of Servants of the Damned, Giant Law Firms, Donald Trump, and the Corruption of Justice. The Storm We Made by Vanessa Chan. Isn't every man a good man and a bad man? Asks Cecily Alcantara, the protagonist of Vanessa Chan's debut novel, The Storm We Made, which is set against the lead-up to Japan's invasion and occupation of Malaya, now Malaysia, in World War II. The question, posed by a mother to a general who is scheming to overthrow the British, encapsulates the contradiction woven through Chan's novel. Housewives become spies. Saviors become oppressors. Unlikely friendships bloom, and young men endure and inflict horrific violence. This is perhaps the book's greatest power. It makes space for complexity without relinquishing the grip of a good story. The Storm We Made opens in 1945 in Japanese-occupied Malaya, where, despite the hard-won downfall of British rule, hopes of a better colonizer have been dashed. Boys are being forced into labor camps, and girls are kidnapped to become comfort women. The threat of losing loved ones becomes reality for the Alcantara family when Cecily's 15-year-old son, Abel, doesn't come home. We soon learn, in scenes of increasing brutality, that Japanese soldiers have put him to work on the Burma Railway. As the days progress, the tight-knit knot of family comes apart. We witness its unraveling through the eyes of Abel's sisters, Jujubi, who works at a tea house frequented by raucous Japanese soldiers, and a soft-spoken Japanese teacher who takes a liking to her, and Jasmine, who escapes despondency at home while secretly playing with her Japanese friend, Yuki. Chan reveals how war is experienced in bodies and hearts, breaking down the morale of those who remain. She writes, "Would their family continue to exist in the horrific silence of their present, creaking around like tired apparitions in their own home, weighed down by the footfalls of their sadness?" Interspersed with the siblings' perspectives are chapters from a decade earlier, exposing the part Cecily chose to play in the Japanese invasion. Her role, stealing intelligence from her husband, a bureaucrat for the British administration, and passing it to General Fujiwara of the Japanese Imperial Army, who woos her with dreams of an Asia for Asians, and with his toxic charm. Tired of being underestimated, Cecily uses her invisibility cloak of femininity to effect change. Consequences be damned. At first, the point of the dual timelines feels uncertain, although it does provide context for Cecily's guilt about her family's disintegration. Then the threads converge, forming a braid that proves to be stronger than its individual parts. This is a novel concerned with power, how it's given and taken, whom we must align with to get close to it, and the consuming desire for more. From the cunning general to the tormented son locked in a chicken coop, characters are constantly striving, their destinies driven by the persistent gurgle of want. Chan never shies from the intricacies of this hunger. It eats at Cecily, fostering delusion and inviting humiliation and shame. But simmering beneath all of this is the will to dream for the self, the family, and the nation. "I don't think it's a bad thing to hope," says a boy who befriends Abel in the labor camp. This boy saves his toilet paper rations to draw faces, to record life, using his own blood as paint. At times, Chan's narrative feels strained, the distinction between nation and family, between men and lofty plans for their country and women with quieter ones for their children, is drawn too cleanly. There's a tendency to over-explain both the thematic shades of the novel and its historical context, which, while complex and under-recorded, can stand on its own. Often, I felt the hand of the author leading me to conclusions, and wished she trusted me more to find my own way. Indeed, the power of this story is such that I would want to. What makes the book pulse with life is not the grand sweep of its ideas, but the tenderness in its details, the ordinary ways that these characters love and laugh in the face of the extraordinary. Unexpected friendships abound, but they are never frivolous. In each one, Chan conjures the transformative possibilities of love when we allow others inside. Your enemy, looking like you, recognizing yourself in the enemy, made it so much worse because it mirrored back to you all the darkness you held, Jujubee thinks. Yet Chan shows us, with clarity and care, how the truest mirror comes from the intimacy of human connection. This review was written by Janika Oza, whose debut novel is A History of Burning. Penning Poison, A History of Anonymous Letters by Emily Cockayne. Long ago, in a moment of youthful discontent, I stumbled upon a primitive listicle on a now-forgotten website that advised the reader on how to deal with feelings of dislike. Alongside the expected bromides, perspective, self-reflection, jogging, the author suggested sending an extravagant gift anonymously. It was impossible, apparently, to loathe someone on whom you had lavished such generosity. This advice was so bizarre, not to mention expensive and time-consuming, that a part of me wanted to follow it immediately. I imagined deluging mean-spirited internet commenters with seasonal bouquets and exquisitely packaged boxes of citrus fruits. Maybe nice soap, the kind that comes in a cube, is flecked with lavender and exudes rustic elegance. There was something to it, even though the thought of intruding on the recipient's lives in such tangible form gave me a weird illusion of power, and no one would know it was me. Anonymity creates disinhibition, Emily Cockayne writes in Penning Poison, a lively survey of the practice of sending anonymous letters with the aim or apparent aim of unsettling the person they were sent to. The author, a historian whose prior work has focused on neighbors and stench, among other things, is clearly qualified to explore this phenomenon, which sheds light on community dynamics, even when the sender's individual grudges must remain something of a mystery. What, for instance, might impel someone in 1894 to suggest via anonymous note that a grieving mother was about to bury alive her son, a curate who was very much dead? That letter, with which the author opens her sprawling history, combines several qualities common to the genre. It's inscrutable, it's sinister, and it involves a man of the cloth. So-called poison pen writers in England between the years 1760 and 1939 were, we learn, obsessed with vicars. Cockayne ends her conscientious study where she does for a few reasons, in part because modern technologies effectively rendered the poison pen genre obsolete, but also to avoid offending surviving correspondents, or, one assumes, moving them to sue. Needless to say, it also spares writer and reader the impossible job of wading through the bottomless mire of digital poison. Even restricted to the age of ink and paper, this is a capacious subject. And, given that not everyone cherishes extortion attempts as family heirlooms, one that requires no small measure of scholarly digging, but her sample size is large enough that she provides the reader with a rough taxonomy, breaking the topic down into categories like threats, obscenity, libels, and tip-offs. Cockayne's letter writers range in class and profession. There are libidinous engineers and boatmen's widows. A slightly creepy Valentine keeps company with a polite death threat. Addressees are accused of professional indiscretions, enough dark financial secrets to power a trollop saga, and, of course, love affairs. In one way or another, Cockayne writes, most malicious anonymous letters concern themselves with reputation. Certain themes are perennial. Serial killers have traditionally found the unsigned taunt a natural medium, as have their copycats. There's the aforementioned vicar fetish. One early 19th century vicar was himself a poison penner, not to mention an arsonist. Then, as now, those who felt powerless assumed swaggering personas and targeted public figures, often vicars. It seems the author finds that being able to observe the reactions was worth the risk of exposure. Everywhere there was anger, paranoia, loneliness. The late Georgian and early Victorian eras might be called the golden age of the poison pen letter, as an obsession with privacy, secrecy, and revelation created a natural breeding ground for anonymous letters and their malicious abuses of information. Notions of honor had secrecy at their heart. Zones of intimacy and trust could only be created and maintained by close control over private information. Some cases were serious enough to attract the attention of the police, and salacious enough to attract the press. In 1912, one Eliza Woodman found a skinned kitten on her doorstep, followed by the only slightly less upsetting flurry of obscenely abusive notes. Her next-door neighbor, another respectable matron, was convicted of the harassment and served 18 months before it was discovered that Woodman had written the notes herself. She was also responsible for the cat. Often these highly personal matters went unreported to the police, only to be discovered by later generations. Sometimes authorities dismissed the cases as unworthy of their interest. In any event, during the period Cockayne covers, detection was no easy business. Invisible ink mark stamps and early cryptology were unreliable at best. The shame of suspicion and the inability to clear their names proved unendurable for more than one accused writer and recipient. The author chronicles several tragic episodes of death by suicide. As a coroner remarked of one such case, the pain of receiving taunting anonymous letters that referenced a past criminal conviction was, for the victim, more than he could reasonably bear. Read this as a comment on the essential human condition. perhaps even as an unlikely vehicle for escapism to a time when these cases were, at least, not a quotidian fact of public existence. Can we ever truly know what a writer has in mind? For this reader, what Cockayne has actually written is a history of that most devalued currency, privacy. By examining individual cases and how, when, where, and most important, why, Cockayne has produced something thought-provoking and humane, the opposite of a poison pen letter, really. Revenge by Harry and David is somewhere between the two. This review was written by Sadie Stein. She is an editor at the Book Review with an interest in English literature. Mercury by Amy Jo Burns. We meet the main players of Amy Jo Burns's poignant new novel, Mercury, in that golden moment between childhood and adulthood, when they're young and strong, and it's just dawning on them that their worlds were circumscribed at birth. The story is set in Mercury, a down-on-the-heels town near Pittsburgh, and revolves around the Joseph family, the owners of a local roofing company. Mick, a volatile father of three, expects his sons to continue the business. His wife, Elise, is beloved around town, if somewhat cold at home. She's the glue who holds the family together. In 1990, just a few weeks before the elder two Joseph sons are to begin their senior year of high school, the beautiful Marley and her mother blow into Mercury in their teal Acura with the windows down and the radio blasting. Not long after they arrive, two outfielders catch Marley's eye at a baseball game, Baylor and Waylon Joseph, who have V-shaped torsos and dark hair. One taunts the other. They get into a brawl, and Marley clambers down the bleachers to climb the fence and force the brothers apart. With this single act, her fate is set. She becomes lover, mother, arbitrator, therapist, and boss, every possible thing to the two boys and their younger brother, Shay. Burns frames the novel around a gruesome discovery in the attic of the Presbyterian Church. Summoned to fix a leaky roof, the brothers find a decomposed body hidden under old choir robes. Every narrative needs a situation as well as a story, and Burns proves the point. Her whodunit and motive feel unimportant and at times unnecessarily confusing. But Mercury is a character-driven novel. The point isn't the plot, but what the people enacting it reveal about themselves. Though the book covers only 9 years, there's something epic about the love story at its heart. And it is a love story, even if there's little romance involved. The Josephs, Marley, maybe all the people of Mercury, none are terribly articulate about how they feel and what they want, so they express themselves by fighting, drinking, and disappearing. We know early on that Marley marries Waylon Joseph while still in high school, but which brother Marley truly loves is one of the many driving forces in this novel, a stronger one than the body in the attic. Another is the question of who deserves Marley's loyalty. Which brings me to Elise, the lone woman in the family before Marley comes along. She doesn't seem to like Marley very much, but she does recognize something in the young woman, a capacity for loyalty, perhaps, or the potential to be a successor. But Marley is not Elise. She reflects the arc of a mother's life shouldn't have self-sacrifice as its inevitable pinnacle. For me, this idea sums up the defining difference between women now and so many of the ones who came before us. No, we will not lose our minds and identities in order to get dinner on the table and clean clothes into dresser drawers. No. And so the most powerful tension in this novel doesn't come from the dead body. It comes from the question of whether Marley will demand a place for herself and for her voice to be heard. This review was written by Mary Beth Keene, whose latest novel is The Half Moon. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.